All right. So with this class and the next class, we'll be finishing this text. So by the end of the night, we'll have gone through the whole of Narada Bhakti Sutra. This is officially class 3, but we need to finish up class 2. And just to remind you about class 1 covered the first two chapters, right? And basically, the first two chapters of the text is about, what bhakti is. Bhakti is, translated as devotion. Remember I told you yesterday it comes from that Sanskrit verbal root, bhaj, B-H-A-J, which means to share in or participate in. So devotion means that you participate in the being of another or in something else other than yourself. You share yourself with something or someone else. And so the first two chapters are really on like what is bhakti and what are its benefits, right? What are its benefits? And the bottom line benefit of any kind of devotion is that you get to lose yourself for a while. You get to like stop being you, say your name to yourself for a while, because you say your name to yourself is the problem, not the solution. And I've mentioned several times before, you try it out in your own experience. Check it out in your own experience. We are happiest when we stop being self-conscious. We are happiest when the little voice inside shuts up and we can lose ourselves in someone else or something else, in another activity. It can be our work, it can be our hobbies, it can be our children, it can be our loved one. But we are happiest when we're not there, when we can vacate and actually merge with what's happening. You see? I mean, it's kind of pathetic how little we spend in reality, in what's actually going on, and how much of the time we're just caught up in our own heads. Just thinking about what's going on, or thinking about what should go on, or thinking about what's already happened, right? If you do a little bit of mathematics, how much time do we actually spend in the present moment? And, if you've tried it, if you've done, a little personal experiment on this, it's really, really sort of sad how little time we actually spend in what's happening now, here and now. And how much of our time is spent thinking about what's going to happen or what's already happened. In my case, I think, maybe yours is different, but in my case, I think it's about 30%, maybe even less, 25, 30% of what's already happened. About 60 or 70% of what's going to happen, I think, what might happen. And about 5 or 10% of what's actually happened. Right? So in other words, we're spending almost all of our time in a time that's not yet come or has already been, which means it doesn't exist, right? The past doesn't exist, right? It's gone. That's why they call it the past, after all. It's past, right? And the future hasn't come yet, so it doesn't exist either. So the only time that actually exists is in the present. Is the present. And the present, of course, is constantly changing, right? As soon as you try to find the present, it's become past. So the devotion is really, one way of thinking about devotion is its interest in what's happening now. It's a kind of an absorption into what's actually happening now. And that's kind of a secret of happiness. Of being present in the reality of life, instead of fantasizing about what might be happening or reminiscing about what you think already happened, right? So the first two chapters are about what devotion is and how awesome it is to find something to be devoted to, because it gets you out of yourself. It gets you out of that loop. That constant loop that's going on in our minds that's keeping us from reality, keeping us out of reality, keeping reality at arm's length. Fantasy, you see. In the Indian traditions, The big problem is ignorance. Sometimes they call it avidya, but sometimes they call it moha. Moha means delusion. And we're in delusion almost all the time. When we're thinking about when we're fantasizing about the future or thinking about something that's already happened, that's delusionary. It's delusionary. Because it's not real. It's not what's going on now, right? Just in our own heads. So that's the first and second chapter. How awesome devotion is, and especially the devotion that the text calls parama prema. Remember what parama prema meant? What's prema? Oh, forgot already. It was yesterday. 24 hours have gone by. Prema. Prema is love in its proper sense. Okay? Huh? And parama. Parama means highest, right? Yeah, divine love. So what is love, you know? What is prema? What kind of love is prema talking about? And it's not the usual kind of love that when we think about love. It's not like, what can you do for me, love? See, I love you, what can you do for me? I love you, I own you. Because I love you. Don't talk to him, I love you. Right? Don't do hobbies that I don't like. I love you. This kind of possessive, egocentric love isn't really love, actually. It isn't really love at all. Real love is, what can I do for you? See, not what are you going to do for me, but what can I do for you? Love is devotion. Real love is devotion. So prema, that's what prema means. Egoless love, selfless love, love for another, you know, dedication and love for another. And parama means the highest one would be the love for what is ultimately real, you see. Love for the divine, love for God, whatever you want to call it, higher power, love for the force, like in Star Wars. Was anyone else amazed that Swami Atma did not know what Star was? She may be the last person on the planet. All right, so you know, without further ado, let's finish up chapter three now. So I'll just quickly go through what we've been through on chapter three, because I know a number of people here are new. Chapter three goes into the methods for cultivating devotion. So, you know, we talked about the fact that devotion, love, is something that we have kind of innately. I mean, almost all humans, and animals too, actually. You know, animals are quite devoted to their young, right? All animals are. You know, they take care of their young. And that's devotion. So we have it almost instinctively in ourselves to be devoted to someone else other than ourselves. But if it's going to be a practice, a sadhana, you see, bhakti is a sadhana. It's a practice, devotion. We have to practice it, and we have to learn how to practice it. So there was, you know, in the third chapter of the Narada Bhakti Sutra, there's a number of, you know, of methods listed, you know, chanting and singing and listening to stories and, you know, and thinking, remembering, smarana, remembering all the time, you know, that there's a higher power, that the appearances of things are not how things really are. Cindy was talking about this in her class earlier, right? That the appearance of separation is an illusion. The appearance that we're all atomistic individuals separated from each other is moha, is a delusion. It can't be. We are all interrelated. None of us exist independently. We only exist interdependently. Only. So I'll come back to that, because that's like kind of where we left off, I think. So he goes through some methods here in chapter 3, and then he mentions one very, very important method for cultivating devotion. And that's finding a spiritual teacher that you can devote yourself to. Finding a guru, what they call a guru in Eastern traditions, or a lama in the Tibetan tradition. And I failed, because I ran out of time last class, to call your attention to the exercise for this class, exercise 2. So just quickly turn over to page 12, I think, in your reading. Each one of these classes has a little exercise, and you know, ideally you do the exercise for at least a week each. And this one's probably the most important one in the course, okay? This is a real takeaway from the retreat, okay? You can go home and start practicing this exercise, and it will change your relationships. Or your money back, okay? Guaranteed, or your money back. And the exercise is simply this: to pick one person in your life, somebody that is close to you, someone that you know, hopefully the best person would be someone you live with or have a kind of a daily relationship with. So your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your best friend, your child, your mother, your father, pick someone and practice thinking of them as a guru. You know, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, that, you know, there isn't a kind of a factory that churns out gurus. You know, the guru for you could be anyone. It's not that they have to have a certain kind of clothing or come from a certain culture, or their eyes have to go this way or that way, or, you know, they have to have no hair or have long hair. It's not like that. Those are just externals, right? The guru could be anyone for you. But here's the secret, okay? And so if the guru could literally be anyone for you, why not bring the guru into your home? Then they can really get at you. Then they can really, you don't have to wait for like 2 years for the Dalai Lama to show up in Australia again. You know? You don't have to wait for weeks on leaks till you find somebody with robes on and, you know, long hair or something. You could be practicing what we call guru yoga every moment of every day. Okay? Simply by assigning someone to that role. Because that's really the only way you have a guru anyway, is that you allow someone to be your guru. The guru doesn't like come and say, here I am, I'm a guru, now you be my disciple. The disciple says, I will take you as a guru. So why not make that an intimate and personal relationship? This is a very powerful practice, okay? And you know, I'll give you this practice, and within 5 minutes you'll say, no, that's, they're not my guru. They couldn't. A guru would never say that to me. A guru would never leave the dishes unwashed like this, you know, because we have this sort of like really funny and very egocentric idea of what a guru should be. A guru should be somebody that's always propping you up, that's always saying, oh, you're so awesome, and they should always say things that just like simply astound you, and you know, and all of that. They should be really abnormal. You know, if they're not abnormal enough, then they really can't, like, really be a real guru. Well, how would that actually be very helpful to us? To have, like, some totally different abnormal person in our lives that we can't even relate to. You know, it's like we have this sort of, you know, at least if you're like me, you have or had this fantasy that a guru should sort of, like, you know, like almost a cartoon. They should be, you know, they should be able to fly, and maybe they come down in some like flying chariot with their like Superman cape flying in the back, G maybe on their breast. You know, I'm the guru, you know. And they're all, you know, shining and golden, and maybe can walk through walls and stuff, and certainly can read your mind, although we don't want them to read our minds all the time. Just when the minds are, you know, properly readable. You know, we have this fantasy of a guru. So drop the fantasy already. I mean, all fantasies function to keep reality at arm's length. All fantasies function to keep us from actually embracing, you know, reality as it is. So the fact is, okay, this is how this experiment works. This is how this exercise works. So follow me along here carefully, okay? You find somebody close to you. This is, the easiest way is to find somebody that you love, okay? Because they're already kind of special to you, aren't they? Like, why else do you love them, you know? Isn't it kind of amazing, for those of you who live with, you know, partners, isn't it kind of amazing that someone has chosen to live with you? Isn't that kind of like awesome that somebody would actually choose to want to be with you? Like pretty much all the time, to give their whole lives to you? I mean, like, is that a special person to you or not? Like already you're sort of like creeping up on Guru Yoga by just thinking about what an amazing thing it is that somebody wants to be with you. Is it just me, or, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, for most of us, like, I mean, I think for pretty much everyone, we all know, like, our own flaws and, like, how difficult we are and, you know, all of that. And then somebody comes along and says, you know, I don't care, I love you. I'll live with you. I'll sleep with you. I'll stay in the same room with you for hours on end. It's just like, you will? Really? All right? So here's how it goes, okay? So you already got a little, like, you know, you've got a little head start on it. And then you say, like, actually, if I'm honest with myself, I actually do not know who this other person really is. We don't know who other people are. You know, we get little clues of what we think they are, you know, on the basis of what they say, on the basis of what they do. But we can't get into other people's heads, right? We don't really know who they are. So given the fact that you don't know who this special person in your life really is, you know, you have two choices, really. Neither one of which are confirmable. One choice is, they're just an ordinary person like me. Although, like, you know, they're kind of weird because they actually want to be with me. But basically, they're just an ordinary person like me. That's one choice, and that cannot be confirmed. Because you can't crawl into their heads, and you don't know. So what's the other one? That they've been sent from HQ on my case. That they're special. That they're divine. That they are the portal to the sacred for me. And you can't confirm that either, actually. But which choice would be cooler? I mean, neither one are confirmable. One is, well, it's just ordinary. They're just ordinary. My life's ordinary. Everything's ordinary. Or this person is an angel. This person is special. This, you know. Okay? So you pick the cooler choice. And then the work begins. Because then, this is Guru Yoga, okay? Then having just chosen some unconfirmable option, then you say, and everything from now on that they say and do is a divine message for me. Everything, without exception. They don't like slip in and out of being divine. Because this is our first tendency. It's going, well, they'll be divine for as long as it's pleasant for me. You know, yeah. They'll be my guru until I say no, I don't like that. Gurus don't do that. You know, flunk them from guru school or something like that, right? No. No matter what they say, no matter what they do, what can I learn from this? Yeah? And like I said, 100% guaranteed to change your relationships. 100%. I've had the honor of officiating at, I think, about 10 or 12 weddings. And I insist for any couple that I'm marrying that we have some counseling beforehand. And this is the fundamental advice that I give to any couple. This is how you have a good relationship. Okay? Now, here's the other thing, okay? There are people in this room whose partners aren't here. Or, you know, or whatever, your best friend, or, you know, it doesn't have to be your partner, it can be, but it's somebody close to you, it'd be good. You don't tell them, oh, from now on, I'm going to think of you as my guru, you know, angel sent from HQ, okay? Then it's about you again. You know, look how awesome I am. I just came back from this retreat and I heard about this, like, really wacky practice, and I'm going to try it with you. Hey, just do it, you know, quietly. Just do it in your own mind. And see what happens. Like I said, you know, if you're like pretty much everyone else, it'll last for 5 minutes at a time before you say, no, no, no. And then you just get back up on the horse and try again. Especially when it's difficult, okay? So, you know, Cindy and I have been talking about how we want to, you know, we want to include in the weekend something about when it's hard, when devotion is hard. And devotion can be hard. Devotion can be hard in all kinds of ways, no matter what or who you're devoted to. There will be dark nights of the soul. There will be times where you say, you know, like Jesus did on the cross, my God, my God, why have thou forsaken me? You know, where'd you go? I thought you were with me. I thought you were my friend. I thought you were my protector. And then you left. And if you practice this kind of guru yoga, if you practice this, any kind of devotion, you will have times like this, including in your relationships, in your daily relationships. You'll have time where, like, you know, no, this person doesn't care about me anymore. They don't love me. My guru has left me, right? This person that I assigned on Monday as my guru, by Wednesday, doesn't act like a guru, doesn't seem like a guru anymore. And then the work begins, you see. Then the hard work. You know, Swami Atma was talking last night, you know, she said two different things at two different times, which is, both are true. That bhakti is the easy way and bhakti is the difficult way. It is the easy way because we have these natural inclinations to serve someone else. We have a natural inclination to love. But it's hard because it doesn't always seem like the love is coming back. See, then it gets hard. and then we have to think, well, what did I think when I started this practice? Did I think it was going to be all about me? Did I think that I would just get more props for my ego? Is it just a exchange? I will love you if you love me back. You see, then you're challenged to say, can I love even when it appears that the love isn't coming back? Can I continue to love? And what can I learn from the experience of having the guru ignore me, or the guru not do the dishes, or the guru yell at me, or the guru leave me? What can I learn from that that will help me, because it's all just a teaching? You see, remember that first, you know, it's like signing a contract. The contract is, from now on, everything this person says or does is meant to be a teaching for me. And that's how you bring the divine into your life, okay? Into your daily life, if you're interested. See, most of us would like to keep the divine in a cage, in, you know, out in our shed, you know, and go and visit it once in a while and go, hey, look at my divine, my God, here's my God in the cage, you know, in the... Isn't it awesome, you know, my divine being here in a cage? You got to let the sucker out and let it run amok a little bit in your life if it's going to really change you, you see. If it's not just going to be like some ornamental form of religion, ornamental spirituality, you know. If it's going to really, you know, get its claws in you, you got to open the cage and let it run. In your house, you know, not just out in the shed somewhere. So that's guru yoga, like triple X guru yoga, okay? The easy form of guru yoga, I've had many, many students come up to me and say, like, you know, we talk about religious teachers, spiritual teacher. You have a spiritual teacher. Oh, yes. Who's your spiritual teacher? His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And you go, well, that's awesome. Wow. Your spiritual teacher is His Holiness the Dalai Lama. How often do you see your teacher? Oh, I see him every year, at least once a year, you know, he comes around, he comes to New Zealand or Australia or maybe like Thailand, and I go and see my teacher. And I sit on row, 73, seat B, and look at my binoculars down at my teacher. Hi, Guruji. Hi, Lama. Can you see me yet, Lama? Dalai Lama's awesome. It's nothing, I'm not dissing the Dalai Lama at all. But that's an easy way to have a guru, you see? That's real easy. In Tibet, there's a saying, the best Lama is the Lama that lives three valleys away. Because you can just idealize them over there, Oh, Lama, oh, Lama, right? But if the Lama's in your face on a kind of a day-to-day basis, it's a different story, isn't it? So try it. Personally, I think, Cindy's got a lot of stuff that, that she's teaching you too, that's awesome. But this is really awesome, okay? I mean, if you wanted a takeaway that would really change your life, try exercise for class two.
I did this with my 9-year-old daughter.
Oh, good on you.
She was the one who bought me, who really wanted me to do the 3-month course.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was interesting. I couldn't get pregnant, and I was living in China, and my friends took me to a temple, and they did something. They rang a bell. Priest said, "You're going to have a baby girl." I was 42 years old. 9 months later, I have a baby girl.
So there was from HQ, sent from HQ.
Well,
all right. So we left off in chapter 3. We talked about guru yoga a little bit, and then he goes into this sort of lifestyle stuff about kind of living in solitude, spending more time alone. Most of us could use more time alone. More time with ourselves. If you don't like being with yourself, who is it that you don't like being with? You know what I mean? If you don't like being alone, it's not a good sign about some self-acceptance, You should be your own best friend. The Bhagavad Gita says the self is its best friend and its worst enemy, which is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's true too. That's true. So lifestyle changes like this. Spend more time alone, more detachment from worldly things, from, just the rat race of making money and keeping up with consumerism and buying the next iPod, iPhone 7B or whatever they're at now, stuff like that. Then we left off, I think, at 3:15, isn't it? Third chapter, 15th verse. It is one who renounces the short-term results of actions. This is a reference to karma yoga in the Bhagavad Gita of doing action without concern for the fruits of action. Page 11. Doing action without the selfish concern for what am I going to get out of it. The whole of the Bhagavad Gita, is one repeated message on how to act in the world like this. Acting without selfish intent. There are things that we need to do. So, Bhagavad Gita is a great, someday we'll maybe do a whole retreat on Bhagavad Gita. That's an awesome text to do on. It's not, the Gita and many other texts, including this one, says repeatedly, it's not about not doing anything. We have to act in the world. We have responsibilities. We have to pay our bills. We have to raise our families. We have to, we have to assume, we have to fill our role in the social world. But learn how to do it right. Learn how to do it without the ego getting involved at every step. So do what, the Bhagavad Gita says, do your own duty, svadharma. Do your own duty, whatever it is that you're called to do. If you're a doctor, be a doctor. If you're a college professor, be a college professor. If you're a sparky, be a sparky. Whatever it is that you are, fulfill that role. If you're a father, be a father. If you're a mother, be a mother. Do your own duty, but do it without ego. do it without, what am I going to get out of this? See, it's there for you to do, so do it. But without attention to what they call the fruits, phala. Without attention to what the result will be. So I put it here, the short-term results of action. There will always be a result to every action. Okay? That's karma. That's called karma. There will always be a result to every action. But the result of actions doesn't come immediately. What immediately happens after an act is actually not related to the act. It's very difficult for us to get our heads around this. There's always a gap between an action, a cause, and a result. So what happened? Here's a really obvious example of this. If you have any kind of, you know, if I ask how many people believe in karma in this room, a lot of hands would go up. I'm not going to do it. A lot of hands would go up. Yes, yes, I believe in karma. What goes around comes around. If I do good, good will result. If I do bad, bad will happen to me, right? That's not just the principle of karma. That's the principle of morality. Any system of morality, you know, has that as its present, as its assumption, right? Principle. So here's an example. Cindy was talking about this actually. You go to great lengths to prepare a nice meal for your family. Have I done this one with you guys before? Maybe you shop all afternoon at some like fancy foodie market and get all of the kale. You buy a lot of kale. And then you spend hours and hours and hours, preparing this meal. You put it in front of your family. Are those hours and thought about, you know, what a nice meal would be and how I could make a nice meal for my family, is that good or bad, do you think? Is that a good karmic cause or a bad karmic cause? It's a good karmic cause. You're thinking about someone else, right? Thinking about somebody else. So then you put the meal in front of them, and they say, "What's this shit?" Or, right? Where's McDonald's burgers or something like that? So is that the result of the cause of thinking about somebody else, shopping for them, spending hours cooking for them? Is that the result? Does it seem like the result? Yeah. You see, appearances are deceiving. There can't be a connection. If there's a connection between that, then all bets are off when it comes to morality. If something bad can come from something good, or something good can come from something bad, then there is no system. Then it's just all random. Okay? So don't worry about the short-term results of your actions. See? If you do something good, good will come, but let it go because you don't know when it will come. You don't know when it will come, and you don't know what form it will take. Okay? So, you know, the belief in karma requires a bit of a suspension of disbelief, you know? Nobody really knows the exact workings of karma. Only enlightened beings, they say, know the exact workings of karma. So give it up. Give up the fruits. Do good because good is good to do. And have some faith, of course, that, you know, that every result, every cause will have a result. But you don't know when the result will come, and you don't know what form it will take. So what's the point of thinking about it too much? You know, just have some faith in the system. Number one, and number two, don't worry about it so much. Just do good because virtue is its own reward. Yeah. So that's the renouncing the short terms of action. And then who renounces ordinary karma. That's kind of like what I just said too. And thereby becomes free from dualistic thinking. So that's kind of where we left off. Free from dualistic thinking. So what is dualistic thinking, you know? And that's all. We could do a whole, you know, kind of retreat on dualistic thinking too. And what it means to, you know, kind of transcend dualistic thinking. Here's just for our purposes, kind of bottom line on this. The idea that you and me are separate is dualistic thinking, isn't it? I'm one thing and you're another. And that is an illusion, for one. And so become free from dualistic thinking means that you become free from the illusion of separateness. None of us are separate from any of us, from anyone else. We are all in a vast network of interdependence, a web of interdependence. No man or woman is an island. And that's the form of dualism that Bhakti tries to get us over. The illusion of separation, of dualistic separation. Who would you be without others? Okay, just as a thought experiment. If you never had any relationship at all with anyone else, who would you be? And I'll tell you what, you would be nobody. You would be nothing. Actually, not, you wouldn't even be nobody. You would be nothing. Right? We don't have relationships. Okay? We are our relationships. Our very identity, our very sense of self is based on relationships, is a product of relationships. Okay? Has to be. So you can think about that for a while. Okay? This is one of the fundamental forms of ignorance that we all go around with. Thinking that, I'm in here and nobody's really listening, nobody really knows me, and then once in a while I bump into other people who are also just like in there in their own little worlds, and we have no real essential relationship with each other. The relationships are superficial and accidental. And that's just an illusion, and it's the cause of suffering. In the Buddhist tradition, it made the... Buddhism has got, we got lots of lists for how many sufferings there are. There's the list of 10, there's the list of 5, 6, right? It made the short list in one sort of, enumeration. The sense of being alone is a cause of suffering. It is suffering, is a form of suffering. The sense that we're just by ourselves. And it's an illusion. We are not by ourselves. None of us is an island. No one could possibly, exist for a moment without relationships. See? Even if you're all by yourself in the middle of in the middle of the bush somewhere, you're still in relationship always, right? You're in relationship with something outside of yourself. Something, the bush and you are in a relationship. Even when you're alone, and let alone what's going on in your head, the kind of ways that we are shaped by our relationship, no matter where we go, whether we're alone or in company, we've all been shaped by our relationships, right? All right. It is the one who gives up attachments even to the scriptures and organized religion who obtains complete and uninterrupted love for the divine. So here he's saying, don't be attached to even to the scriptures, even to religion. Don't be attached to anything. Be free. Of course, he's like back and forth on this. He's back and forth, as a good teacher would be. See, don't be attached to the scriptures, but don't be... the word antinomian? Antinomian means you just don't have any rules at all. You just don't care about any rules or regulations at all. Libertarian, or what's that other word?
Libertine.
Be a libertine. We just don't have any guidelines, any rules, any checks or balances on your behavior at all. So it's a kind of an interesting balance between not being overly attached to the rules and regulations, not being overly attached to your spiritual life, but not being completely licentious either. You see? He crosses over. He helps everyone in the world to cross over. This is one of the several places in the text where he says that someone who has true bhakti, someone who has transcended themselves and their selfishness, is actually a really positive force in the world. And we kind of have a sense of that, right? We admire in the highest way, spiritually, those who are the most humble. The Mother Teresa's of the world, the Mahatma Gandhi's of the world, the Dalai Lama's of the world, These aren't people who are arrogant and pride. There's no Saint Barry the arrogant. You know what I mean? We don't give sainthood to people who are prideful. We give it to the humble. Like Jesus. Jesus became the servant of others. He washed his disciples' feet. He became the lowest of the low. And if you believe in karma, what's the karma of that? Being the lowest of the low resulted in him become the King of Kings. Right? And having 2,000 years later, people, you know, going to churches and worshiping him because he was the ultimate servant. He wasn't presenting himself as, you know, I'm the greatest, I'm the king, everyone should worship me, right? All right, here we go. Class 3. Thought I'd never get there, didn't you? The true nature of pure love, prema swarupa, the true nature, the swarupa of prema, is indescribable. Can't touch this. Can't say anything about it. Whole text on something that you can't say anything about. You know? Cindy was sort of pointing out the irony this afternoon. It's like a mute person trying to describe how something tastes. First of all, even somebody who can speak can't really describe how something tastes. You know what I mean? All you can do is compare it to other things that taste similar. But if you don't know like what the taste is, you know, you can say, well, you know, it tastes like tomato sauce or something like that. If you don't know what tomato sauce tastes like, you know, what does it mean to say that, you know, tomatoes taste like tomato sauce? You know what I mean? Let alone somebody who can't even talk. How are they going to describe how something tastes? So this is, you know, these verses are about how the essence of prema, the essence of love, real love, true love, is totally indescribable. It's experiential. We have to experience it. Remember those verses, I forget which chapter they're in, about the king? All of a sudden, we came to like some king who was talking about his castle and his food or something like that. And it's all about like, you know, king won't enjoy his castle and won't enjoy the taste of food unless the king inhabits the castle and eats the food. And similarly with prema. You won't know what it is. You can't know what it is until you experience it. Until you do it. And, you know, spiritual life as a whole is like this. You know, I've done many, many, you know, teachings and retreats and stuff like that. And you know, I just sometimes wonder, well, what's the point, really? You know, how many of these people are going to actually go and try to do it? Try to put it into practice? Because if they don't, then what's the point, really? It's just a waste of time, in a way. It's just like so much time wasted to just talk about stuff. You know, if it doesn't get put into action, then there's really no point to it. There's no real effect to something that's purely theoretical when it comes to the spiritual life. It has to be experienced. It has to be put into effect. So he's saying that about love too, about prema, about, you know, parama prema, the highest love, is that, you know, you got to try it. So, and it's not like, I've got to convert to Hare Krishnaism or I've got to convert to Buddhism or something like that. Try it with your home lama, with the guru who lives with you. Child, partner, parent, best friend. Try it there and see if it works. You see? And that's it. This is how you develop what they call faith. You know? Faith, you know, when you hear the word faith in English, almost always our temptation is to put an adjective in front of it, which is what? Blind. Blind faith. We always think of faith and we think of blind faith. Faith, real faith isn't blind at all. Real faith develops from experience. Real faith comes from like seeing how putting something into practice works, and then you get faith. See, then you get stoke. You get stoked up about it because you see, oh my God, you know, if a little bit of effort can make this kind of difference, what if I really put my back behind it, you know? What if I really got down with this? Then I could really change. But you can't, you don't get there until you try, you see, you gotta try. So like in all spiritual, you know, kind of practices, it helps a great deal to have a sense of desperation. Because then you're willing to try something that you don't really know will work until you try it. You're willing to try it because you know what doesn't work. Okay, and in this case, when it comes to devotion, what we know doesn't work is selfishness. What we know doesn't work is just thinking about me all the time. And it's not anybody, no one in this room has not had plenty of experience thinking about themselves. We're all experts at it. We've spent our whole lives revolving around ourselves, self-centered. How's that worked out? You know? Has it brought you the happiness that you thought it would bring? You know, this is why we do anything. We do everything because we think it's going to bring us happiness and relief of pain. That's why we do anything. That's the motivation for everything in our lives. Is that, well, maybe this will make me happy. Maybe this will help me avoid suffering. So does selfishness bring you happiness and help avoid suffering? And you know, if you've paid attention at all to your own life, you'll realize, of course not. It's in those relatively rare times for those of us who aren't really trying, we're really, you know, putting it into practice. It's in the relatively, you know, rare times when we slip into selflessness that we're happiest. And so the practice of bhakti, the practice of devotion, is to learn how to do that as a practice. And in order to get some faith in that practice, it helps a lot to realize that the alternatives don't work. That selfishness is dysfunctional. We all want to be happy. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy. But we have to learn how to really be happy. We have to learn what's going to work to bring us true happiness. We have to learn what's in our true self-interest. Enlightened self-interest, not selfish self-interest, you know? The lower self-interest brings us less happiness and more pain. But enlightened self-interest is what's going to really produce the goods, you know? What's going to really bring the happiness that I'm looking for? And that is to let go of the selfishness more. That's the best thing you could do for you. The best thing you can do for yourself is to stop thinking about yourself all the time and think about somebody else and how you could serve them. All right. It is free of limiting qualities. So you say here, he's talking about, he's extolling the virtue of this kind of devotion or love, prema. It's free of limiting qualities and of base desire, kama. It's free of selfish desire. What am I going to get out? I want, you know, because of what I'm going to get from it. It increases moment to moment, which is also not the case with selfish desire, with kama. When we desire something for ourselves, when we get it, it's done. That particular form of the desire is done. Then new desire comes up, right? A different one. You know, isn't it like that? Like, as soon as you get something that you desire, then some new one, this isn't good enough. I want something else now. You see this with, this is how the economy is running. This is how the consumerist, capitalist economy runs. Is that it's constant game of bait and switch. You know that term, bait and switch? You put the bait out, and as soon as they go for it, you switch it. You should have an iPhone 4. You say, yeah, I want the iPhone 5, I want the iPhone. And as soon as you go for the iPhone 4, guess what? iPhone 5. Oh, you just have the iPhone 4? Oh. You know. Oh, you just have this version of that? Well, now there's this version. You know, and constant, over and over and over. Huh?
Siri,
yeah, you don't have Siri. What, your iPhone doesn't talk to you? So it's not like that kind of desire. It's the kind of desire that that increases uninterruptedly without like this kind of like jagged ups and downs. I get something, I want something else. I get something, I want something. It just grows exponentially, like uninterruptedly. It takes the most subtle form of consciousness. It becomes the backdrop of your whole mind, of your whole being. It's like it perfumes the room of your being. Love, you see. It's kind of like in this text he's talking about prema, right? But in the Buddhist text, for those of you who've been studying Buddhism, they talk about bodhicitta in exactly the same kind of way. Bodhicitta, the wish for enlightenment for the sake of all other beings, perfumes your consciousness. You know, no matter what's going on in there, no matter what particular thought or feeling that you're having, it's all influenced, affected by this kind of, like, you know, perfume. Prema, devotion, could affect every aspect of your life, every thought. When one achieves that love, one sees, hears, speaks, and thinks about it only. It affects the way that you live in the world. It affects the way that you are. Its secondary form. So now we get to the, you know, a little more technical stuff now. So he's talking about his primary form. Parama prema, the highest form. Now he turns to its secondary form. Threefold. Secondary means its practice form. Okay? It's not its completion form, but its practice form. How to practice devotion. And he says, there's a secondary form that has three sort of levels to it. And then he lists two different versions of three different levels. The Buddhists are all loving this. So, you know, the Tibetan Buddhists are all like, lists, oh good, lists. According to three kinds of qualities or according to three divisions beginning with distress. Okay, this is where you really need a commentary. What the hell is that? What is he talking about? Three different kinds of quality. Guna beta. It's divided into three, the divisions according to qualities. Guna is a technical term in much of Sanskrit Hindu literature. It means that the constituents of reality, the constituents of the world, including the constituents of people. So it's a kind of an interesting classificatory system. You can divide anything up in this way. There's sattva. Sattva means purity. Goodness, sometimes they say goodness. There's rajas. R-A-J-A-S. Rajas means activity. And then there's tamas. T-A-M-A-S. You can apply this scheme to foods, for example. So there's sattva foods. They're very light, you know, yogurts, you know, pure foods. Then there's rajas foods, you know, very spicy, North Indian cuisine. And then there's tamas foods, which I think is Italian. You know, heavy pastas and stuff like that, that you eat them and then you kind of just go to sleep afterwards. You can apply it to animals. You know, there's sattva animals. The cow in India is a sattva animal. You've sacred cow and all like that. There's rajas animals. A horse, for example, is a very active rajas. And then there's water buffaloes. You ever seen a water buffalo? They just like slop around in there, big. And so there are people like this too. There are sattva people, you know, whose inclinations are very, you know, kind of light and, you know, pure and good and, you know, like that. And then there's rajas people, people of action. And then there's tamas people. And then, you know, that's just because one or another of those qualities dominate. We all have some version of each three. It's all just a combination. Okay, right. So here he's saying that there's a secondary form of bhakti, a secondary form of a sort of practice form. Let's call it just a practice form of devotion that can be divided according to the gunas. So this is not, so keep in mind, this is not ultimate parama prema. This is secondary prema. And it's secondary because each one of these are somewhat flawed, okay? There is the practice of bhakti, of devotion, for those practitioners who act out of the quality of tamas. Sometimes they translate it darkness, inertia, heaviness, okay? And so what kind of practice would that be? It would be people who are devoted in a kind of lethargic way, you know, who kind of like, you know, don't have a whole lot of, you know, interest in it, but get around to it once in a while. It can mean like something like that. Or just go through the motions a little bit, you know, just by rote a little bit like that. Or it can also mean people who are very, people who are practicing devotion because they're in great pain, personal pain, and want relief from it. You see? It's very self-centered, you know. But it's still devotion. Okay? Better than nothing. Then there's the sort of rajas types, the active types, who are kind of very hyperactive about their devotion, you know? They're constantly like doing stuff and filling up water bowls, maybe. You know? They're very ostentatious also, you know? Maybe make them flamboyant, you know, kind of about it all. Very goal-oriented, maybe. You know, trying to get to the end of get to the end of bhakti as soon as possible. You know, get to the goal as soon as possible. But they are energetic and they're passionate, and that's okay. That's good. Again, better than nothing, right? And it also in the text it says in the very next verse, in both cases, what is previous is superior to what follows. Okay, so actually I'm doing it in reverse order. So we're doing it hierarchically. Starting at the lowest and then moving to the highest. Okay. So then there's sattva prek. And you know, sometimes people who are familiar, or a little bit familiar with Indian religion, think that the goal is to be very sattva-like. Actually, it's not the goal. It's not the ultimate goal. It's better to be sattva than to be tamas. It's better to be, you know, practicing kind of purity and goodness and all like that. But it's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to transcend all three of these gunas, actually. As this text makes clear. Because these are all secondary practices. So what would a sattva practice of devotion look like? It would be well-intentioned, but perhaps a bit polluted by the need to look spiritual. You know? When we come to ashrams like this, and you know, or even in, like, you know, come together at Marie's house for class or something like that, we're on our best behavior, aren't we? You know, because we're around other people who all, you know, are supposed to all be like, you know, kind of spiritual too, and we don't want to look bad. And you know, that's probably, you know, there's a good part of that. That's, you know, there's value to that. It, you know, it kind of restrains us a little bit from just like saying and doing stuff that, you know, just because we feel like it. Well, no, how would I look if I said that? Right? But it's a little polluted too. The motivation isn't pure. Okay? So sattva forms of devotion can be very, very well intentioned and all like that, and be very outwardly very, very good looking. But there's still a little bit of selfishness involved. What about me is still involved. Then there's the other one he says is the other triad here, the secondary form, is three divisions beginning with distress. And this is, unless you know, you would never figure this out. This is a reference to a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, good people, he's talking about good people, he's talking about like, you know, spiritual people, virtuous persons, come to me for three reasons. Again, he says, in a secondary way, there's three lower reasons that people come to me. And then there's the highest one. So it's three and then one. Just like here. He's talking about a threefold secondary form of practicing devotion. And then there's the fourth one, the parama prema, which he's already talked about in the text. Everyone okay? Okay. So in the Gita, he says there are three kind of virtuous people. So he's talking about virtue, but whose motivations are somewhat sullied. They're not pure. They're not absolutely pure. So beginning with distress, those in distress, people come to me. You know, Krishna says people come to the divine because they're in deep doo-doo. Because they're in pain, they're in distress, they're scared, and that's the lowest of the three. The second one, he says, is people driven by intellectual inquiry. People who intellectually have figured out that this could work. You know, they've had like lots of classes on the Narada Bhakti Sutra. And took good notes and thought about it and meditated and maybe did some outside study and said, you know, that bhakti thing, you know, that makes sense to me. That could work. Then the third one is those who are seeking their own advantage. And my understanding of this means enlightened self-interest. Those people who have figured out that this is the best thing I could do for myself. Is to devote myself to someone else. But again, myself is involved here. You know what I mean? It's not the fourth one. It's not the pure one. It's not Parama. It's not the highest one. It's better than the other two, and the other two are better than nothing at all. You see how it works? Hierarchically. Okay, so those are the three triads, the two triads that he's talking about here. Devotion, he says. Now he turns to kind of devotion more in general. Devotion is an easier path than any other. So we've talked about this throughout the whole weekend of devotion being the easy path. Here he says it quite clearly, quite explicitly. Saulabha. For those of you who are paying attention to the Sanskrit, there was a durlabha. Labha means to obtain, obtain. Durlabha means hard to obtain. And in the verses on finding a guru, finding a teacher for you, spiritual teacher, it says that's very durlabha, very hard to find the right teacher for you. So here he's saying saulabha. It's the same verbal form. Labha means to obtain. Sau means good, easy. No worries. No worries about devotion. Easy. So again, like Swami Atma said last night, it's the easy path and it's the hard path. It's easy in the sense that we're naturally inclined to it. It's hard in the sense that we trash ourselves all the time. We trash our best instincts all the time. You know, it's a little bit like we all want to be free, we all want to be liberated, but we all simultaneously do exactly the wrong things to be liberated. We choose to do exactly the wrong things. We all want to be happy, but we choose to do exactly the kinds of things that keep us unhappy. So, very easy. It's very easy to practice the way of devotion as long as you stop practicing the way of non-devotion. And we're all kind of attached to selfishness. We're attached to ourselves, and it's hard to let that go. The proof of this, that devotion is an easier path, is self-evident, he says. Svayam pramana. Svayam means it's its own evidence. Svayam pramana means it's its own proof. Just do it, and you'll see. You don't have to like argue for it. You don't have to like prove it in using anything other than just experience to know that devotion is the easiest and most powerful path. It does not depend on any other proof. So here he's calling up a technical word in Indian logic, pramana. There are three kinds of pramanas, actually. Pramana means proof. There's pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means right before your eyes. I know that there's a coffee cup here because it's right in front of my eyes. I see it. I feel it. I know it. It doesn't have to be proved in any other way than the fact that I can just see it, right? I don't have to make some big, elaborate, logical proof that there's a coffee cup in front of my eyes here, right? Yeah. And he's saying that devotion, the power, the efficacy of devotion is kind of like that. Doesn't need any more proof. Then there's another kind of proof called anumana, which is inferential. inferential logic. Okay, so everyone watch. This is a little, you know, experiment here. So, is there a coffee cup in my hand? Can you, projection means right before your eyes. Can you see it? Okay, so how do you know that there's a coffee cup in my hand? You infer it, right? You saw it before in front of me. You saw me move my arm back here. You didn't hear the coffee cup drop, or you haven't seen me do magic lately. And so you can make a logical inference that the coffee cup's still in my hand, right? The third kind of pramana in Indian logic is according to authority, according to absolute, to an authority that you absolutely believe in. So if somebody or a text or something like that that you absolutely believe tells you this is the case, then that also functions as a kind of a proof for you. Here he's saying it's not three and it's not two. It's not authority and it's not inference. It's right before your, it's experiential. It's right before your eyes as something that needs no other proof, that devotion is its own reward. Because one has dedicated oneself and all one's worldly and religious activities, there's nothing to worry about when it comes to relinquishing the world. We've had verses like this in earlier chapters. Renunciation comes naturally with devotion. Renunciation means renouncing spending your whole life on stuff that won't pay off for you. Doesn't mean like you can't have any money or you can't have any fun anymore. It doesn't mean that at all. But it means letting go of the idea that money, job, occupation, serial relationships, anything outside of yourself can provide the happiness that you're looking for. So with devotion, this kind of like detours, these kinds of distractions fall away naturally because you're interested in only one thing. You're interested in devotion and love. I thought I'd stop here to let you Aussies know what the Sanskrit is for nothing to worry about. No worries, okay? So now you can really impress your Aussie friends by instead of saying no worries all the time, you can say chinta na kariya. Chinta, say chinta. Na kariya. Yeah. It makes for no worries, literally. Upon accomplishing that, one should not stop engaging in worldly business, but rather do it as a practice. So again, another one of those verses where he says, this isn't about just, you know, when we're talking about renunciation, we're not talking about, you know, quitting your job and leaving your family and, you know, all of that kind of thing. We're talking about a mental thing, not a physical thing. One should not stop engaging in worldly business, but do it as a sadhana. And so what is he talking about as a sadhana? Your whole life. He's not talking about like do your sadhana for an hour in the morning or a half hour in the morning. Your whole life should be your practice. Sadhana means practice. Religious practice. And then he says, and don't forget, renouncing the short-term results. Pala results, fruit, jaga. Not for any other reason than itself. You see? Do it for its own sake. Virtue is its own reward. Do it, don't do it to, you know, for what you're going to get out of it. Right? And then it becomes like play. It becomes lila. In Sanskrit they call it lila, play. Play is a very interesting concept. I mean, I've talked about it before with some of you guys. There is no purpose to play. Right? You don't play in order to get something out of it. You know, children are the best examples of this. You know, because we're all corrupted when it comes to play. We want to win when we play. But children play for their own sake, you know. What's the point of swinging or going down the slide, you know? What's the purpose of that? And you know, there's no purpose. The purpose is for itself. It's its own reward. And here he's saying, and devotion is like should be like that. Not for what you can get out of it, but because it's cool to do in and of itself. It's a way of bringing the goal and making it the path. The goal and the path collapse. The means and the ends collapse. They are the same. When you practice devotion thoroughly, you are practicing the goal. You are inhabiting the goal of living, you know, purely selflessly. One should. So then he says, now here's a little more lifestyle recommendations. And also he's kind of talking about what renunciation, what he's talking about when he's talking about tyaga, renunciation. One should not listen to gossip about women. Isn't most gossip about women, actually, when you stop and think about it? No? Not necessarily? Okay.
We gossip about you guys all the time.
One should not listen to gossip about women. Well, it's written by a man, so you can substitute your gender there. Wealth, you know, what are the rich doing? You know, what's going on with who's that?
Gina
Reinhart. What's going on with the Reinhart family? And the conduct of the irreligious. So religious people love to talk about the conduct of the irreligious. So just mind your own beeswax a little bit. Yeah, that's right. You're a good example. Pride, abhimana, hypocrisy, dambha, which also can mean deceit, and other vices should be given up. So pride, of course, is the opposite of devotion. Pride is the opposite of, you know, humility and devotion are hand in hand, and pride is the antidote really to real devotion. And then hypocrisy, you know, be transparent with other people. The putting on a face different from the one that you wear is a sign of selfishness also. It's a sign of self, grasping to self. Because you want people to think of you as somebody other than who you really are. You have a sort of self-image that you want to, you know, represent that isn't really who you are. So it's interesting. Hypocrisy, deceit, and so forth is a form of selfishness. It's a form of self-centeredness. With everything one does, being fully dedicated to that one, dedicate all your actions to the sacred, to the divine. What is done out of desire, anger, pride, etc., is directed toward that one only. So this is one of those kind of cool and controversial verses that say even your mental afflictions can be used for religious purposes. These are, you know, desire, anger, pride are, you know, kind of the beginning of a long list of all the mental afflictions we have. So with devotion, you can use those mental afflictions also for devotional purposes. Here's how, okay? Desire, you know, you're supposed to usually be bad to desire. Desire, instead of desiring stuff for your own, you know, selfish gains, desire a connection to the divine and desire that strongly. Use desire as the desire to become more devoted. How else are you going to get more devoted unless you desire to be more devoted? So use desire. Have pride. Take pride. You know, pride is, I just said pride is sort of the opposite of devotion. But here he's saying, well, you could jujitsu it. Cindy did a whole teaching on jujitsuing pride, didn't she? Yeah. Jujitsu pride. How? Take pride in your efforts to be humble. And then anger. Even anger. He's anger. Anger at what? Anger at your own self-cherishing tendencies. Get angry about that. Get angry about the selfishness that's causing, that's preventing you from true happiness. Use them. Here's a quote from, this is a last name's Prabhu. He's got about six or names before that. He wrote a commentary. He's the head of the Hare Krishna class. And he wrote a commentary on this text, Narada Bhakti Krishna, Narada Bhakti Sutra. He says, we may practice becoming greedy, desire, right? We may practice becoming greedy for chances to spread the word of Krishna. Krishna Bhakti. We may become greedy for the chances to spread the word of Krishna. Proud that Krishna is our Lord. And angry at the obstacles that prevent us from attaining bhakti. Alright, last verse here. Breaking out of the limitations of the three secondary forms mentioned above. So now he calls our attention back to that verse where he's talking about the two threefold divisions of secondary devotion. Breaking out of the limitations of the three secondary forms mentioned above, one should act out of pure love alone. Out of premaiva. Prema eva. Only prema. Only love. Not stained by self-interest in any way. Acting always as the pure, with the pure love like that of a servant, dasya, serving the master, or a lover, kanta, adoring the beloved. So here he mentions, kind of in passing, two of the bhavas, two of the attitudes that you can take towards the divine. Regard the divine as your master and serve them like a good servant. Cindy was talking yesterday about, you know, what they really mean here. They're not talking about being servile. They're talking about somebody, maybe you know people like this. She mentioned somebody that we know, who's just so attentive, you know? They're just constantly looking out for what they can do for someone else, you know? And there are people like this that they're just always, like, you know, kind of trying to what's the word? Second guess, you know, trying to predict what it is that you might need, you know, and then provide it without being asked, without being. So it's not about, like, you know, do this for me, you know, master servant relationship. It's about that kind of service that just wants to. Wants to make someone else, you know, happy and comfortable. It's that kind of service. And then a lover adoring the beloved, like someone infatuated. The gopis were infatuated with Krishna. Teen Krishna, right? That kind of infatuation. Yeah. All right, so 1 minute to five. And... So that leaves me 1 minute to give you your exercise for class three. Anyone notice the time? Exercise for class three. Pride is the opposite of devotion and the humility that accompanies it. So this week, let's work on pride. And one way to work on pride is to make offerings. And offerings, you know, they can be made in all kinds of ways. I suggested here that you kind of couple this with your home guru yoga practice. So now you've got your guru at home, and you're thinking about, like, everything that they say and do as a divine message to you, as a teaching, you see. Then you're learning all the time, you see. A teacher can't teach you unless you allow them to. Unless you put them in the position of being a teacher, they can't teach you anything. So you're putting your partner or your child or your mother or father or your best friend in that position of being your teacher. What do I need to learn from anything and everything that you say and do? And then you know, this exercise is to honor them as a teacher, and to say, well, you know, what could I do for them? What could I offer to them? Honor the guru you choose to work with last week by doing little acts of service or present them with small gifts, maintaining an attitude of gratitude and respect. And, of course, the greatest offerings, it's not an offering if there's some expectation of return. It's just not an offering. Then it's It's an exchange. Yeah, barter. It's a barter thing. And almost all of us, almost all the time, give gifts like this only. I'll give you something, and do you notice? Do you see what I gave you? I mean, minimally, we want to be thanked for it. So minimally, we want that return. More often, we expect something coming back in a kind of a bigger way than just thank you. So it's an offering when it's done completely selflessly, without expectation of return at all. So that's another takeaway. You can start making offerings to the people that you're devoted to. You know? I'll just tell you quickly. Cindy and I live out in the country, and you know, I came over to a completely different continent 4 years ago to live. And so when we moved to our house in East Gippsland, you know, we were pretty aware and still are aware of the fact that we live on somebody else's land. You know. We are being hosted. And so we make offerings every day to the spirits of the land. You know. Put out little bowls and, you know, light some incense. It's not a big deal, and it takes about 5 minutes. But to do something like that every day reminds you of, that you're obligated, that we're all in the service of something, that we all are been given, you know, something, some great gifts in our lives, and to just make a little effort like that. It works too, I think, more or less. Haven't had any trouble. Not yet, anyway. All right, take a break, and we'll meet back at 7:30. Is it?